Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in, well, some of our favorite games. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
I'm absorbing energy from Earth's yellow sun.
Well, when you're going to go ahead and fly through the air at supersonic speed and use eye lasers, just let me know.
Oh, you'll know. You'll all know.
Well, today we are going to be doing some more questions from you, our wonderful listeners out there. And if you do have questions for this or any of our other podcasts, that includes the Blizzard Watch podcast or our brand new monthly podcast, Tavern Watch, which focuses mainly on tabletop role-playing games and the realm therein, you can go ahead and send those in to podcast@blizzardwatch.com, as well as on our Discord channel. If you are a Patreon subscriber, you have a Patreon Q and supporter question section. You can ask them there. Several of these actually did come from there. And if you don't have Patreon, don't want to do the email, but you still want to do Discord, we do have one set aside for Q and podcast questions. All we ask is that you specify which show it's for. And otherwise, Matt and I, we kind of get into a wrestling match and my back hurts. I don't want to wrestle much anymore.
So. Yeah. And you know, I was actually good at wrestling.
Yeah. I don't want to. Matt's also got reach on me, which doesn't help.
Well, no, I mean, I'm serious here. I actually won I won the freshman states the year I wrestled.
Oh,
I was actually pretty good. That wasn't a joke. I mean, you may be good too. I don't know. But I was. I was sincerely a good wrestler.
Well, one day we will have an episode about the lore of Matt and Joe, but today we're going to talk about some questions that you folks have for us. And our first one is going to start off with some Diablo questions. If you have not noticed, this weekend the beta for the Diablo 2 Resurrected came out. Several of us have been playing it. I actually did stream it on the Blizzard Watch channel on Twitch on Friday. That was actually it's been a pretty good time, but that has led to people having several questions about the game itself. And this one comes from our friend LD Soth. What lore do we know about the Countess in the Black Marsh in D2? We have the tome that starts the quest, but that's general and vague, and most of the rogue encampment NPCs are just like, oh yeah, that things. Forgot about that. I feel like it would be like living next to the tomb of King Arthur and pretending no one had ever heard of him. Thanks for all you do.
No, the Countess is not like living next to the tomb of King Arthur. It's like living next to the tomb of Countess Bathory, because the Countess is Countess Bathory. It's a straight up rip from real history. Countess Bathory was a Hungarian nobleman, I believe, who decided that bathing in blood would restore her youth. Yeah, and that's exactly what the Countess in Diablo 2 is. That's just what she is.
If you're familiar with Castlevania, it's where the whole Carmilla thing comes from as well.
Yeah. So when we see the Countess in Diablo 2, it is literally just a reference to the real life person. They put in minimal lore, just that she's there, that just that she kills people and uses their blood to try and preserve her youth forever. It's a vampire riff. It's the riff on the Countess Bathory, a real life person. I don't know how true the actual, like, there's debate among historians as to if Countess Bathory actually ever did anything like that. Like, it's a story that was told about her, but there's significant debate among historians as to whether or not the woman actually killed people for their blood. But it is the story. It became folklore. It became kind of mythologized. That's what it is in Diablo 2. It's literally just a reference to that. However, she pops up again in Diablo Immortal. So if you're wondering what happened to her after that, 6 years after you kill her in Diablo 2, a cult of blood-worshipping lunatics bring her back by sacrificing an entire town.
I mean, feels sort of rather fitting that blood-worshipping lunatics decided to bring up the Blood Countess.
Yeah, absolutely. But they use one of the shards of the World Stone to do it because, you know, remember, at the end of Diablo 2, spoilers for a game that came out in 2000, at the end of Diablo 2, the Lord of Destruction expansion, Tyriel blows up the World Stone because Baal has infected it with demonic essence, and thus it's going to transform all of Sanctuary into a tainted hellish abomination, and where all the people will be servants to the primevals and thus useful for the war against Heaven. He decides, I don't want that, so he destroys the World Stone, freeing us, but causing shards of the World Stone to rain down over the entire world of Sanctuary. Somebody gets a piece of it and uses it in a ritual that kills literally everybody in a town called Blackstone to raise her from the dead. But it's not enough. She doesn't come back all the way. She comes back as a monstrosity, and thus she needs even more blood. So that's your job in Diablo Immortal, to go kill her again for good. Let's get her down this time for sure. She was a noble woman in Kanduras. She decided that she didn't want to get old because it's not good. As someone who got old, I can understand her point. She's bathes in blood, so she literally bathes in the blood of 100 virgins in the game, but they bury her alive because they're like, oh, we don't like it that you've killed 100 of our virgins and we want you to stop murdering people. So they bury her alive, and that's when you go to the tomb. She's some kind of monstrosity and you kill her. Maybe she's a vampire, but it's never really clear. But then she comes back and we're going to see her again in Diablo Immortal when presumably we will kill her again. There's not much more lore to her than that.
Now, as far as the actual meat of the question, I think is the idea of how can people in a world like this not know if such a creature exists?
In this world?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think people have this, idealistic idea of how the world in Diablo 2 was for some reason, but like it is a very dark and fractured world. That is sort of its entire purpose. It is grim dark. That's what it is supposed to be. Pockets of humanity don't necessarily communicate with each other very, very well. Oral tradition is the thing, which is why like you have people like Deckard Cain and folks that like gather the lore and try to put them in books or try to record them and try to keep them alive. But you also have tons of these powerful people that and groups that exist that try to keep all of their secrets, well, secret. They don't want to share because there's demonic corruption. There's been crusades. There's been all sorts of like campaigns to like stamp out perceived, corruption or infection of demonic presence. Like these are core tenets of Diablo and Diablo 2. And it even starts with, you know, in the very first cinematic of Diablo 2, when you are watching the person in the robe go and speak with the person, Marius, I think it is, Marius in the insane asylum, and he's talking about him, you know, oh yes, the Dark Wanderer came and this is what happened. But even then, like the den before the Dark Wanderer shows up, it's not a happy place. These are people doing drugs and drinking to escape the harsh realities of their world. So stories about a person that may or may not be like dipping themselves into like virgin's blood, it's just kind of the norm. Like, I hate to say it, but like, that's not even the worst thing that's happened in this world. And so,
I wanted to point this out. The Countess was entombed hundreds of years before the game.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like recently. Have you ever heard of Herman Webster Mudgett?
I have not.
About Dr. Henry Howard Holmes.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Who was he?
Holmes was a serial murderer, wasn't he?
Yes. Do you know where his house in Chicago was? There's lots of people live in Chicago. Do you know where, like,
I don't know specifically where it is. No, but yeah. Again, even in portrayals of that story, they don't tell you exactly where it is. It's just a thing that it was there. Right?
We live in a mass media culture where there is literally, like, I'm sure you heard about it on like a documentary or from some TV show talking about murderers or some book about murderers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
The people in Diablo do not have any of that. There is no network you could just turn on and be like, you know, here's the thing about serial killers. And keep in mind, Mudgett only died in 1896. That's only a little more than like 120 something years. And he killed 27 people in his murder house.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where there's places in Chicago called the Murder Castle.
Yeah.
Because,
that was what his house was referred to, as the Murder Castle with all the traps and everything else.
Yeah. He was not, besides being a serial killer, he was also a con artist and a trigamist, the subject of more than 50 lawsuits in Chicago alone. Like this was a seriously, and he's a footnote that Joe and I know about because we like obscure trivia.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go to Chicago, you could go right to the neighborhood where he lived and you wouldn't know anything about him. It's not like people talk about it. It's like, why is this guy important? So, that murder house, we know about that. People move on. Life moves on. It's not these people that you talk to when you get the quest. Sure, they kind of know about the place, but
they're more focused on survival. They're not worried about a 100-year-old tale, right?
Yeah, your daily life, even in a place that isn't as horrible as Sanctuary, Chicago has its problems, but there's no demons actually erupting out of the ground. It's just stuff moves on, time moves on. Sure, here's another example. You mentioned King Arthur. You have no idea where King Arthur lived.
And all we know is stories, right? We don't know how accurate any of that is.
Oh, there's a ton of debate about how accurate it may or
absolutely.
May not be. There's some historians think there was a figure who inspired the Arthur tales. Some people think that they know who it was. Other people think, no, couldn't be that guy. And that's like, that's a couple thousand years ago. That's like less than 2,000 years ago, because it would have been around 8,400, 8,500. That's 1500 years ago. There's stuff is forgotten, stuff is lost, people don't pay attention to it. As Joe pointed out, you're living in a world where towns vanish because demons ate everybody. It's not that big. It's not this countess who isn't even killing anybody at the moment. Sure, it's a creepy story, but come on.
Yeah, and think about the rogue encampment in particular too, right? Like when you go back and you ask about it in the rogue encampment, it's an encampment, it's not a city. Also, like you walk outside of that encampment, there's carvers, there's fallen, there's undead, there's all sorts of like shambling creatures. Goatmen are not too far away. Like it is not a place where you have the time and luxury to worry about something that may or may not actually be there. You have clear and present danger in front of you that you need to respond to. And that's one of the things about Diablo that I think you always have to keep in mind whenever you're on any of those quests, is that world is filled with so many immediate threats. And when Diablo 4 comes out, I have a feeling it's going to be much the same, because the world is even worse place than it was when we left it in 3. Right. So they have things that they need to worry about. They don't have time to research. They don't have time to sit in a library and dust over dusty tomes and worry about this ancient story that may or may not be real. Some folks do. That's why people like Deckard Cain exist or existed, depending on how Diablo 4 all shakes out. There's reasons why there are archivists, but their work is their work and it's something central to them. And they exist in one place at a time. They don't necessarily have the network of information and knowledge, like Matt pointed out, where they can just flip on a TV or pop online or read an email. Everything is all news travels by people literally traveling and carrying news with them. And that news may get distorted based on how it's being delivered. They may also just not want to share that news. We don't know what's the best example I give is we don't know what's happening in the Skolvos Isles. There's definitely stuff happening there. There's definitely newsworthy stuff happening there. 100%. We know that much. We just don't know what. Nobody's telling us. Nobody's going out of their way to send messengers over the seas back to the mainland to spread the word of what's happening there. Hell, the Amazons weren't even visible in Diablo 3. They weren't there. So, like, the world is very cut off from each other, and that lends it to things that are couched in myth and legend to sort of not necessarily fade away, but it's not people's preeminent thought. It's not the first thing they think about when they wake up in the morning. Like, we have the luxury of doing that on a lore show, And we have the luxury of doing that as people that don't necessarily have those same, you know, demons are coming to eat me sort of worry, but they don't. And it's always one of the fascinating things about the world is how fractured it actually is.
Think about how notable the fact that the Dark Wanderer is wandering is.
Yep, always eastward.
That's the fact that they named him that. You know, he's the Dark Wanderer because he's going someplace. Like, they don't go places.
Mm-hmm.
The trip from Khajistan to Kandoras to create, you know, the West March and Kandoras kingdoms was a big deal. That was a once in a lifetime crusade type thing. They don't happen all the time. People don't travel back and forth like this. There's trade places, but otherwise, if you live someplace, you stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And you worry about your area, your home, your hometown, your farm, the region you live in, the valley you lived in, whatever. So yeah, I don't think it's that surprising people didn't know about the Countess. But there really isn't much more to tell you about the Countess. The Countess is a crazy noble woman who liked to dine in blood and bathe in blood because she thought it would keep her alive and keep her young. That's basically it.
Yep. Our next question comes from our good friend Vertigree. Question for either podcast. Well, I stole it for here because haha. Does Illidan sleep? If he can, does, what possible position would he need to be in with those giant wings and horns? I imagine him sleeping in the seat of the Pantheon while Golgoneth throws several oceans at Sargeras, thereby providing wave noise. Yours, Vertigree.
No, he doesn't sleep.
Okay.
I don't know. No idea. It's never come up.
I do actually find that fascinating, because even in the Illidan book, they never talk about that. Like,
yeah, they also don't talk about whether or not he pees, man.
But I just thought this question was a fun little thing because, yeah, I mean, if I don't know how I would do it if I had, like, horns that big and wings that big. Maybe I would just sleep standing up or sitting up or whatever. Like, I just imagine him, like, falling asleep in, like, a futon or something.
Maybe he can, like, have his wings beat independently of his consciousness. So he's just floating up there with the wings.
Oh, the ultimate air mattress. But who knows? Who knows? He may just never sleep because, I mean, torturing Sargeras is all he needs in life. Our next question comes from Tetsemi. Question for Lorewatch and or the Q. Now, this would be an interesting story development. How would you like to see this play out? There is a link to a Terran Gregory status in which is evening conversation with friends yielded from this very non-canonical gem. Vindicar lands. Velen gets out. Greetings, Prophet. How was the moon? Velen grabs his staff, locks and loads, get back in the Vindicar. Prophet, the moon's haunted. This is a reference to the moon's haunted Destiny 2 thing, obviously, but it is absolutely hysterical. Like, how would you react if, like, literally Velen just came to you and said, yep, we got to go, like, murder the moon or something like that?
I'm not going to murder the moon. The moon's like a giant egg and a monster comes out of it, if I know my Doctor Who storytelling. I mean, who knows? I don't think he means that, you know, the moon itself is the problem. I think he means that the moon is haunted. So you have to go up and deal with all the things haunting the moon. We just had a big portal rip open in the sky. Who knows what came through and haunted the moon?
So I guess, I mean, into a larger perspective, with all the information that we've gotten about Ilune,
is he talking about the moon? We don't know if he's talking about Ilune the figure. We don't know if Ilune the figure is in any way related to the moon.
That's what I was just going to ask. Yeah, that's what I was going to bridge into as a question. Like, do we honestly think that there is a connection between our moon and Ilune?
Our moon, no. The moon Ilune, maybe. Because there's two moons on Azeroth. One is like the
White
the
Mother and the Blue Child, right?
And the White Mother is one that they also call Ilune. So quite possibly she lives on Ilune or has something to do with Ilune. I don't know. Ilune might be involved in Ilune, but Ilune might have nothing to do with Ilune. Wow, I said that out loud.
The only reason I bring this up is because we have been getting a lot of other questions from listeners and just people in general, especially with things that have happened recently in the game, highlighting the relationship between like Ilune and in particular the Winter Queen. There's been a lot of speculation that because the Winter Queen is blue and Ilune tends to be white, that if the two moons are a reference to them and their relationship, we don't know. But it is something fun to think about. And honestly, at some point, like I am starting to question where Velen's been this entire time. And I guess that would be a good caveat or a good lead-in question. So throughout the entirety of everything that's happening in Shadowlands, I haven't been playing Alliance at all. Where's Velen? What do we think he's doing? Like, we understand Legion was, like, a thing, and, like, that was pretty taxing on him. But, like, What do we think Velen's doing? Why isn't he around? This seems like something that would be right up his alley, or something that like he would be definitely at least, you know, hands deep in at some point.
Dude, he's busy. The moon is haunted. I mean, come on.
Moving away from that, do you have any ideas or speculation that you'd like to put forth?
I don't know where he is. Honestly, I find myself wondering if he's not trying to figure out what to do with himself. I mean, the Legion and the fate of his world was a big deal. He got to go back to Argus. He got to see what happened to the world. But now, like, when at the end, like, we left Argus in a hurry. Like, we were chasing after Sargeras. We went through the portal to try and, you know, escape while they were pulling him into the Seat of the Pantheon. They didn't get to go back to Argus. They had to, like, immediately leave. And that's the last time Elune left Illidan there, and we booked it out. And he saw the sword wound on the planet, and that's it. He didn't get to go back to Argus. He didn't get to reconnect with those people that he had just reconnected with, the ones that blamed him for leaving them. He didn't get to do anything about that situation. And now, like, he's, you know, the portal to Argus is gone. I find myself wondering if he's not trying to figure out a way to get back there. Now that the Legion's been dealt with, he might want to reclaim his homeworld.
Yeah.
He might want to fix what happened to Argus. I don't know. There's been nothing. He has not made an appearance that I can think of. He has not shown up. They have not seen him. He's not mentioned in, like, you know, the piece that was supposedly founded between the Alliance and the Horde. I don't think he has any lines.
And he wasn't there at the top of, like, Icecrown Citadel either. Like, when we were doing the opening of the portal to take us into the Shadowlands via the Helm of Domination shards, Velen wasn't there at all.
No, he doesn't even make any appearances aside from taking in refugees from Tildrassil. We don't see or hear anything from the Draenei in Battle for Azeroth. There's no specific Draenei response to it or force involved in it. That's basically they've been effectively a non-presence, especially Velen.
Yeah, and I also find that very, I don't want to say telling, but worrisome when you start to factor in that, like, everything that's happening with Anduin and the fact that at least we can travel between the Shadowlands and Azeroth pretty freely. You figure word would have gotten to him that, hey, Anduin's, you know, been taken over by this horrible cosmic entity. Elune is possibly going to blow up Tirand. You know, the light is being used as a weapon in Revendreth.
We're kind of, that's one of the weird things about this, us communicating back with Azeroth stuff. It's never been fully explained to me. What do they know back there? How fast is the news going? Like, does the average person in Stormwind know that their king is currently the servant of a entity that wants to destroy existence? Does Ghen know that? Tyrallian know that? Ghen and Tyrallian are the ones running the country. Are they aware that the person that they're holding onto the seat for is currently, you know, a puppet in the hands of a dark figure who wants to destroy existence? I mean, hard to say. I mean, we don't really know how much the people know. Clearly, news got back to Talia and she managed to get across into the Shadowlands. But has anybody been seen leaving the Shadowlands and then coming back?
Aside from the Maw Walker, I don't think anybody has. And that, I think, is also another interesting point. Like
if people can't leave the Shadowlands again, I mean, the portal is there, but, like, you know, we know the portal's there because we see it get made. But are people, like, we haven't seen anybody come through, talk to us, leave, and then come back. We haven't, like, heard, like, well, I went back and informed everyone of what's going on. I don't think that's actually happened.
No, it hasn't.
So we don't know how long has passed on Azeroth.
Yeah, and I think,
like, Talia might have shown up because she was looking to talk to Bolvar, not because she heard anything.
Yeah.
She seems just as surprised as anybody to hear that, you know, our friends are being held. We have to save Anduin. Like, she's going on, like, you know, what? You know, she doesn't seem to know any more than anybody else does.
Yeah,
so I don't know. I really don't.
And the only entities we know that have, like, successfully moved between, like, the Shadowlands and back to Azeroth are literally the Maw Walkers, because we've taken broker portals. We've gone through portals.
Yeah, I went and talked to Alexstrasza. Go to talk to Alexstrasza at one point, yeah.
And it's fascinating because, like, yeah, you said, like, they never go back. Like, we don't see reinforcements coming back through either. And I wonder if that's purposeful. I wonder if that's because they realize that going back is a horribly huge effort. The only ones we see really lending anything are the Ebon Blade, which has been established that they can travel between the worlds.
Plus, the Ebon Blade comes through with Bolvar.
Yes.
But they don't, like, when they come through, they seem to have completely given up on, like, the guys who went through into the Maw. And it's we're the ones who go free, like Darien and so forth.
And they're the ones that are able to establish the portal back to Azeroth that we can use is the Ebon Blade.
Is that them? I don't remember if it was them or if it was I don't remember who did it, but okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, it's like, it's one of those things, like up until they show up, you know, I don't know how many people have gone through. I don't know how much time is passing because we keep hearing that time doesn't really exist in the Shadowlands, that it's a concept of mortality. But that means that, you know, we could be doing all this stuff in the Shadowlands, and then we could go back and, like, almost no time has passed. Like, we have no idea. Like, when we go through and tell Alexstrasza what's going on and then go back to the Shadowlands, for all we know, we just told her that. And then, you know, nothing that happens in the Shadowlands. We could go back through and she'd be like, yeah, you told me 5 minutes ago. We were like, look, we've been there for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have no idea. We don't know what's going on with that. So it does... I'd like to know more. I'd like to see more, but I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I've been looking forward to is the sort of like effect or what happens as a result of what's happening with us in the Shadowlands, like what happens back on Azeroth. And I want to see a little bit more about that. And I understand that we've had more pressing things to sort of worry about with for reforging the sigils and going after the jailer and now bringing down Sylvanas and doing all of that and trying to figure out a way to keep him from accomplishing whatever his goals are. But I would also like to have something that talks about what's happening back home, because there is a lot of things like that I just want to know about. How's the Horde dealing with the aftermath of, now Sarfang dying, Thrall being picked up and carried into, and Bane being picked up and carried into the Shadowlands, not returning. How is the Council holding up? How is the aftermath of the betrayal from Battle for Azeroth? All that other stuff.
I got one for you. Are there any trolls who are just minding their own business, talking to Loa, and suddenly Vol'jin steps out and goes, "Hi."
Yeah.
Like, Vol'jin's a god now, guys. What the F?
We are literally hatching him from an egg. I think at this point he's in an egg, being reborn as a Loa to go back to Azeroth. Like, how's that going to play out? You're sitting there in your Zandalari troll and you're praying to Razan and you're expecting a Tyrannosaurus Rex to come out, and it's not a Tyrannosaurus Rex, but it's Vol'jin going, "Hey, what's up?"
Oh no. Oh no. Oh, this would be so good.
Go for it.
It's a Tyrannosaurus Rex with Vol'jin's hair and tusks. That's his new form. He's a T-Rex with tusks and a big haircut.
A Vol'jinosaurus Rex.
Yes. Yes. It's perfect.
Well, I think I have the name of this episode for this week. But yeah, no, but there's all sorts of stuff.
Hey, Mon, what you doing? Ah! Wait, what? Who are you? It's me, Vol'jin. Why are you a dinosaur? Weren't you expecting a dinosaur? I could have just showed up at myself. Oh, right. Good point. I think I peed myself. What is up with you? Oh, I'm your new Loa.
But
now, I'm the Loa of Kings now. Me, Vol'jin. What? How did that happen? Oh, it's a long story. You remember that Maw Walker fella? Yeah, and I keep forgetting, is that Horde or Alliance? Doesn't matter. Anyway, they helped me out. Now I'm the Loa of Kings. Spread that around to all the Zandalari that I have previously been killing in my opposition of their attempt to rule the world.
Yeah.
Does Vol'jin, like, he died before they joined the Horde. Does he know they joined the Horde? I guess he does.
No, he does.
He met T'Lanji.
He's interacted with T'Lanji. And that was established during Battle for Azeroth, is both factions, essentially, whatever your respective, respective perspective is, found the urn and were tasked with bringing the urn to the very specific place and then finding out, like, all those interactions. So, like, we know, both factions know that he's dead, but not really, because you interact with him. That's just a thing. So it wouldn't be that surprising, maybe necessarily, but I think that most of the Zandalari would have no idea who he is. So if they're praying for the Loa, they're praying to Razan, and he shows up, that would be a hysterical thing, because it's like, yeah, you're not Razan. He's like, no, I'm not. I'm Vol'jin. Like, I would be down for that. All right, I think we can move on to our next one.
I'm sorry, but I'm still loving the image of just this big T-Rex with Vulgin's hair. What's going on, guys? It's me, Vulginosaurus Rex.
Yeah. Our next one is from, I think it's Jonah Dewar. It's, why would demons in the Burning Crusade be casting holy spells? Can all beings cast all magics, but instead specialize in their natural magics, as evidenced by Druid casting Arcane and Khadgar using a modified priest spell? Can demons command the light? We've seen some instances of where at least the Nathrezim have definitely been able to call upon the light, or at least show that they are. The question, though, like in some of them, is whether or not they actually are doing it, or whether they're just using their powers of illusion and in sort of basically mind bending abilities to display that they're using light, but aren't actually using the light. But we do know that they apparently can, because there is a Nathrezim that is, Lothraxian. That's his name, right?
Yes, Lothraxian. Although we know he might be the infiltrator mentioned in that whole thing, but yeah, it's Lothraxian.
But it seems like he's suffused with the light, or at least gives off enough of it that other paladins feel like he's got the light at his command. But the other interesting thing, and Matt's pointed this out a lot over the course of years, is that the light doesn't necessarily have a sentience about it necessarily. And it sort of seems like it can be wielded by anybody who's capable of making that connection. Like, I believe Matt loves to point out Zeliak as a great example of that. Zeliak was a horseman of the Naxxramas. He was one of the horsemen of the Lich King, yet could still call down upon the light and still use the light. Forsaken priests can still do it even though they're dead or undead. We've seen instances of creatures and other things being able to call upon the light to do various things, because the light is ostensibly a tool to be wielded. What do you think about why demons possibly could do it, or if they actually are doing it?
Well, I mean, there's the possibility. I don't even know if I would say that it's not that the light doesn't have sentience. It's that we don't understand the light, or how it thinks, or how it feels, or if it thinks or feels. It's very hard to make judgments on a mortal scale of entities that might have transcended existence and that certainly exist outside of our universe. The light definitely seems to be willing to be used in ways that would be offensive to us. Like, it was the light had no problem with Zera using it to like force Illidan into becoming some pure paragon of it. It did not care in the slightest. It did not oppose her. It did not stop her. Illidan stopped her. She was going to do it. She was going to turn him into the perfect weapon of the light that she believed he was destined to be. And there's that whole idea that the void, the shadow, sees 1,000 truths. Anything is possible. The void, the light, sees one truth. One thing is true. One thing is what you're supposed to have. There's supposed to be one true thing, and nothing else can be true. It's rigid and doctrinarian. It's not flexible. It illuminates, and illuminating reveals the truth. So I think that if is a demon using a holy spell, it might be. It might be doing so because it knows how to channel the light to that purpose. Or it might just be that it's a game mechanic. Like, the demon is using the fell to do something roughly akin to healing via chaos. But it's, you know, the game has mechanics. And one of those mechanics is that healing spell is a holy spell.
Which is not necessarily true even in game mechanics, because shadow priests have shadow mend.
Exactly. But it might be that. It might be something as simple as, like you mentioned, Zeliak. Zeliak could control the light even though he was undead and it was destroying him. He could absolutely do it. The light did what he told it to do, not what it wanted to do. The light might not, the light itself as a force might have an opinion and a will, but as it enters our world, it becomes a power source and it can be used for whatever you believe in hard enough. And it's not up to the light to make those decisions. Who knows? This is something I'd love to see explored more. I'd love to see there be like a discussion of it by, you know, characters who would know. I would like to actually see the light and the void become, I don't know if I want the cosmic war everyone keeps saying they want. I don't know if I want like a full-on light void fighting each other expansion, but I would like to see a more nuanced take on how the light works and who can wield it and why. Because there have been, like Joe pointed out, all the stuff you pointed out is accurate. There have been Forsaken using it. There have been undead. There's been a lot of people using the light for a lot of reasons that may not be all that great.
Mm-hmm.
The Scarlet Crusade, plenty of people in that can use the light. And they're fanatics who murder people. People who have nothing to do with what they're upset about. So, yeah, I think that it is something that that could be more explored. And Lothraxian certainly, even if Lothraxian is a sleeper agent infiltrating the light on behalf of the Nathrezim, he is using the light. He's using it. He's not faking it. Like, he's surrounded by too many people.
Yeah,
to be faking it.
They would know that. Like, one would assume that they would know that. Especially somebody is.
Even if you're going to say that, well, he's a Nathrezim, they're inherently deceptive, he could fool people. He couldn't fool all of them all the time.
Yeah.
He spent like 1,000 years on a ship with a Naru and a whole bunch of paladins. He would have got caught sooner or later.
And not only that, like somebody as suspicious as Illyria was, come on. Like, if he was doing something like weird, she'd know. And I think she was skeptical at first to begin with. So like, she was definitely watching him. So the other thing that I think is an interesting question here within the question is the idea of basically not having exclusivity with magic being wielded. And I think there is some truth to that. I think a lot of what we understand as like exclusive, like mages use arcane energy or shamans use nature energy or druids use nature energy, it's not necessarily as cut and dry outside of game mechanics. There's been plenty of established, for lack of a better term, cross-class sort of like influences, right? You point out that Khadgar uses a modified priest spell, or druids can use arcane spells, particularly like even like elves, like they have that sort of like natural affinity for sort of arcane magic. I think that anybody can wield any magic as long as they study hard enough or have the natural inclination. And I think it speaks more to understanding of how the fundamentals of magic work for those people more than anything else. I don't think that just because you're a druid that you can never become somebody capable of casting like an arcane bolt or vice versa. There's night elves in general, right? Like their society was very divided between it. Doesn't mean that they couldn't do the other side of it. They just had people that were like high arcane mages, and then others are like, nah, we're going to be over here in nature land. We saw what happened. But they started as people that were capable of basically doing insane arcane feats. Look at the, why can't I remember the name of them now? The, in Nighthold, Nightborn, like they could theoretically branch out into other magics quite easily because they had that level of understanding, but they were primarily an arcane society. So I think when you start talking about the actual like story of how magic works, it becomes a little more blurred and nuanced as opposed to just pure game mechanics where everything is divided into neat little columns. So, you know, story wise, you could see Khadgar understand, oh, that's how priests do this. Maybe I could do something similar and then do something similar. I think that there's room for that. And as Matt pointed out, maybe demons can do something that approximates what the light can do using fel because, well, it's fel is what? It's the breakdown of light, or it's when light and shadow interact with each other or something like that.
Yeah, it's like raw chaos. It's the explosive annihilation of light. And so, yeah, maybe they can do something like they can mutate you and it's like being healed. I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. But, you know, something to think about for the future. Our next one comes from Elsa, who is a Frost Death Knight on Lothar. Love the name. Very fitting. Okay, so here's another one for Lorewatch, which is less of a question and more of an observation, I think, should be kept in mind when speculating. And of course, I could be wrong. There's been a ton of talk about Zoval's true form looking very drusty, and then from there, thinking about potential leaks. But after looking at the cutscene several more times, I don't think it's the same wicker punk look that the drusts have. Rather, I think that's his original armor, and that what we're seeing on his chest plate isn't wood, but rather just damaged metal. I've been thinking it was more likely the Arbiter was actually part of him, and that's where it was torn out of him sort of thing. Having just finished the final chapter of this part of the story, I'd say that's been confirmed to be the case. Question: yes. And, you know, if this campaign's been out for a couple weeks now at this point, that is pretty much established and straight up, like, when you go and talk with the Primus, he tells you, yep, totally ripped it out of his chest and did the whole thing. we created a construct to go ahead and do this because we couldn't trust him anymore, and then locked him away. And the piece that he just took back, well, that was part of his anima that we ripped out, the part that was capable of doing the judging. So we know that to be true, but that doesn't necessarily preclude it being Drusty, at least in my opinion. And again, this is 100% my opinion. Nobody else's, but it doesn't mean that the Drust aren't necessarily based off of whatever his speculation or his armor was. And when I say that it's Drusty, it's, yeah, it looks like damaged metal, but it looks way more organic, which, unlike most of his followers and most of the creatures you see inside of the Maw, the constructs, they don't seem very organic. They seem very smithed. They seem very created. Even when you're going through the Sanctum of Domination, everything has a very crafted feel to it. But when he gets his piece back, it feels incredibly organic. And I'm pretty sure that that was intentional. They could just have him wearing armor, but it doesn't look like armor. It looks like him, like it's growing forth from him.
Okay. I've been thinking about this for a while, and I think I know what you're talking about. I'm going to show you a picture of something.
Okay.
Obviously, people won't see it, but you'll see it. And I think it is an interesting thing to think about. Uploading it now. That's okay. A Drust from Ardenweald.
So for those of you at home, since this is an audio format, this is the quote-unquote Wicker Punk look. This is the armor that looks very organic. It looks like it is the mask laid over the body of one of the Sylvan.
Yeah, it's specifically a Drust Soul Cleaver.
Yes.
And looking at it very effectively, have you looked at the plate armor that you get for the Covenant in Ardenweald?
Yeah, it's very, very similar.
I don't think he looks like a Drust. I think he looks like Ardenweald.
Okay.
I think he looks like the Heart of the Forest, which was used to hold him in the first place. Remember?
That's true.
We're told that the Heart of the Forest was essential to the magics that bound him. I think that the Drust, when they invade Ardenweald, we know they use the native people of Ardenweald. They put those masks on them and they take them over. It might not be that he is like the Drust. It might be that the Drust are trying to be like him.
Okay.
And I think that's an important distinction, because it doesn't mean that that the Drust have been like serving him or working for him. It might be that they are attempting to use secrets they have found that relate like a template, to him
almost.
Or, you know, you find like a couple of recipes that a famous chef left behind, and you try and make the same food. Maybe you will succeed. Maybe you'll fail. You know, you don't have his full book of recipes. You just got a couple of recipes, but you're, you know, now you can at least know, well, this is how he did this. This is how he did that. Maybe, you know, you can extrapolate from there. Maybe they're trying to use something that they learned. We know that Zoval can do the thing he's done to Anduin.
Mm-hmm.
The thing he's done to Anduin is not dissimilar to what the Drust do.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah.
And it may not be that there's a direct connection between them. They might not be working for him. They may not be, like, you know, inspired by him or anything like that. But we do know that the Drust were Vrykul. The Drust and the Vrykul are related. They were one people at one point, and then the Drust got stranded in Kul Tiras when the big sundering happened and tore the world in half. The Drust ended up on what is now Kul Tiras. There was Drustvar back then to them. And we know that they would have, therefore, there were certain figures that they would have venerated. And one of those figures was Odin,
mm-hmm.
who was the Prime Keeper. And we know that Odin traded his eye to somebody who was working for the Jailer, giving that person a stake in and connection to all the things that, you know, Odin was using the secrets that he gained from that deal to raise his Stormforged and to create his Valkyr. It's quite, and we know that the up in the north, the Vrykul knew about the Valkyr.
They did, yeah, they absolutely did.
They were when the Lich King started showing up with Valkyr, the Vrykul were like, yeah, we always assumed that he got that idea from them. But now we know that he was also part of the Jailer's group, right? The Jailer was working through him. He was the Jailer's power that he was drawing upon. It's possible that when looking through into the Shadowlands, the Lich King saw the Valkyr and copied them. You know, we don't know. there's a lot of stuff we still don't know about the relationship between the Lich King and the Jailer, but it's quite possible that the same thing happened to the Drust. We know that their druids touched upon life and death. The Thorn Speakers, they're very much into the cycle of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
We meet a Thorn Speaker druid in Ardenweald who's like totally down for like the cycle and not at all serving the Drust that are invading. For generations, the Drust served that cycle. Just like the one, the Thorn Speakers we meet today, like the, I can't remember his name, but he's the bear one up in Drustvar.
The one that basically allows Kul'tirans to become druids.
Yeah, that guy. I want to say Ulfar, but I don't remember.
I think you're right, yeah.
That guy is working for the whole cycle of life and death. It's quite possible that it's the Jailer who corrupted Gorakhtul. Gorakhtul didn't want the cycle for of life and death to happen. He didn't want that to be going on anymore.
He wanted to break the cycle.
Yeah, and what does the Jailer want to do?
Break the cycle.
Yeah, so it may not be something like, we work for the Jailer, we're his servants. It might be that they're inspired by him. That they looked into the realm of death and saw him. When we see them in that outfit that looks so similar to the Jailer's, it might not be because, you know, the Jailer is a Drust or wearing Drust armor. It might be that the Drust have taken from various sources things that are inspired by the Jailer. But I do feel like there is a connection. I just don't know
what
we
it
don't
is.
Know. You know, we don't know which came first here. We know that the Jailer existed well before the Drust did, but we don't know if the Jailer came to the Drust and said, serve me, or if the Drust were looking into the realm of death when they were trying to create Thros, and they saw the Jailer, and they learned, like, they're like, ooh, we like this guy, you know? Because we know that the Vrykul up in Northrend were serving Arthas and calling him the Death God, you know? They were looking for a figure, you know? They believed that the Titans had abandoned them, remember?
Yep.
The Titans let this curse of flesh that happened to us. The Titans don't care about us anymore. So they might have turned away from Odin and found a new god. So yeah, there's a lot of possibilities here. I do think there is a resemblance between the Jailer's, you know, armored up form and the Ardenweald armor and the Drust that are wearing various variations on it. But I think that the connection is that it is Ardenweald based.
I like that, actually. I think that is a very good thing that I had not considered. So cool. And hopefully we'll find out some more about that because I feel like.
Yeah, I definitely feel like done. We definitely need to see more of the Drust coming up.
All right. We have one more question left here for today. And this is going to be from Delos, who's a Blood Elf Warlock on the Shattered Sun Blades Edge Realm. So these are based around the Grimoire of the Shadowlands that came out, and particularly some of the stuff around the cover of it. These questions also come with a highlight of the cover from the Grimoire of Shadowlands, where Torghast is visibly layered beneath Ouroboros. If you haven't seen the cover of it, the dust jacket for it is semi-transparent, which is odd for most books when they come out. Most of them are solid pieces, basically meant to protect the undercoating. But in here, it seems like a deliberate choice or art choice that are possibly play into this. So the questions here are, the Arbiter was just an animal construct made from part of the Jailer that was in charge of judging souls. We have confirmation of that. We know that that's part of the latest campaign. We did have a theory that the Maw was initially effectively all of the original Shadowlands and is showing clear decay from whatever it once was. Ouroboros, for all that it's the Eternal City, is pretty obviously a constructed and almost sterile place before the Maw Walker has arrived. The operation of the place was very mechanical and artificial. The art design of the cover of the Grimoire is clearly not accidental, implying that some form of connection between Torghast and Ouroboros. What do you think is being said or implied by all of this combined? Given that you don't know all the specifics yet, because the story is still unfolding, wild speculation is both allowed and encouraged. Thanks again for the great podcast. The sterile comment actually kind of got me thinking, and I think there's a lot of truth to that, too. We've always talked about that Ouroboros felt very constructed or very intentional, and that it might not necessarily have been the original piece that was there. But when you get there, there's nothing but constructs and brokers there. And the constructs, essentially the caretakers, they're very clinical, very programmed in how they tend to things. They have very specific functions. They follow those functions, and that's it. The brokers are sort of like the odd thing out. they don't necessarily follow any specific thing, and the attendants are not necessarily happy that they're there, but they don't have any directives to kick them out either. And it seems like the brokers are kind of sitting there or squatting there on sort of a technicality, because, again, the attendants were never given explicit instructions to remove people from Ouroboros. And you look at Ouroboros, and it does feel like, I don't want to say that there's pieces missing, but it's incredibly small for such a main hub. And one would have expected that if it's going to be a place where souls go to be judged, that there would be more happening there, that there would be more spaces or possibly representatives from the other from the covenants or other lands or things like that, that would there to pick them up, right?
Something you've pointed out before, but I wanted to bring up now because it makes sense. Why, when the Arbiter goes down, does the soul flow that starts in Ouroboros default to the Maw, and specifically to Torghast?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not a design you would expect. You would not think that if you are judging souls to decide where they should go, and one of those destinations is the garbage pit disposal prison where only the worst souls go, that that would be the default setting. Like, oops, the controller is out. Everyone goes to hell. Why would that be your default? Why not? Why wouldn't you default to Revendreth, where it's where people go to be punished for their sins? At least once they got to Revendreth, most people probably got something they could be punished for. Maybe they don't really deserve it, but, you know, it's at least, well, you coveted chocolate cake, but we'll purify you of that, and then you can go wherever you want. Okay, I really regret that. Zoop, that wasn't much anim, but okay. I guess you're going to where do you want to go? Ardenweald? Yeah, sure, fine, go to Ardenweald. Yeah, that cake was pretty good, though. Up, you're back in the punishment chair. I feel like if there wasn't a reason for it, and I don't know what the reason is, I don't know if it's that Torghast and Ouroboros were once one the same place, or if the fact is that we're assuming that they built Ouroboros, but imagine if Ouroboros was the original seat of Zaval when he was the Arbiter.
So I think I have a theory about it, but go ahead.
I'm just thinking in terms of if that was the original seat, it would have been in the Maw, which would have been not the Maw, because they wouldn't have had a garbage dump to send people yet. They didn't have a prison for the worst possible souls. They literally made that for Zaval. So what was the Shadowlands like before? I mean, that's way beyond my pay grade here. I could speculate, but I'm sure Joe's got something going. But I do think it's possible that Torghast looks the way it does and acts the way it does, not because it was built at the same time or is a part of Ouroboros, but because it is a mirror of Ouroboros.
I think that's entirely possible.
Okay, you go.
So I started thinking about this a little bit more, and I'm wondering if Ouroboros did exist, but not in the same way that we think it is now, right? I'm wondering if it was never intended to be a seat of power or a city in all, and that it was supposed to be a funnel. And that's why everything that comes into the Shadowlands passes through it. It's just a collector, and that collector then takes it down to the sorting room. And that sorting room was originally Torghast, where the seat of power possibly originally was. And Torghast gives you that feeling that it's a huge place. Like, the Sanctum of Domination itself is massive. Torghast is a huge and winding place. Why is it set up like that?
Torghast is so big that there's a chamber just off the front door where you can just handily imprison somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, just, and he was big.
And then go into Torghast and look down. Like, go to the middle and just look down. What does that look like? It looks like, again, Ouroboros and sort of like that central chamber. And I'm starting to wonder if Ouroboros is the leftover bit of a filter that was essentially put in place and then beefed up to take on a role that it was never intended to. And I don't think we're necessarily incorrect in our assumption that the Shadowlands was much more connected than it was originally, because if everything went down to Torghast and then, you know, split off from there, that's why Corthia has a lot of that same information. That's why there are these floating lands. That's why they can be pulled into the Maw. It's not necessarily that the Maw, you know, is its own little, I hate to say it like this, like this own little bubble, but it was a piece of it that was broken off from the rest in order to isolate somebody so that they couldn't go anywhere else. And so I'm starting to wonder if all Ouroboros was originally was the soul siphon that took everything that was coming in and directed it to one location. And then that one location is what no longer exists anymore. And instead,
Hold on though.
Go ahead.
Let's go with what you just said. The maw is the piece that got detached so that they could imprison someone in it. What if we go back to the idea that the Torghast and Ouroboros were once like connected to each other? What if the reason that Ouroboros is where it is, and we could see all that stuff from Ouroboros? Remember that you could see anima pathways from each realm to Ouroboros. Is it was literally the top of Torghast.
Also possible.
And when they imprisoned him, they literally ejected it. And it didn't go anywhere. It stayed where it was. And it's the Maw and Torghast that descended into a new plane of existence.
Which is why it's still the default setting when the machinery is broken.
Because the machinery would have just, the soul flow would have just gone, as you pointed out, down to the sorting room, which at the time was in the same place. There was like it was a single tower. But when they broke it off, and it's not that Torghast looks different than Ouroboros because it was made differently, you know, to mirror the jailer's mood. When he was corrupted by what he'd been stripped from him, it changed with him. It mirrors him. It is it's the objective correlative of his state of existence. And now that we've gone through it and he's successfully regained that part of himself that he lost, that's an interesting question. We know that he's looking, possibly looking for that, like, what is it? Zerith Mortis? The thing that he was talking to, it wasn't him. It was Venari and Tal Gorshum or whatever the kiss name is.
Yeah, Zerith Mortis then, yeah.
Someone pointed out to me, I remember I was talking about online about this, that Azeroth and Azerith are not very far off. And we know that the jailer wanted the soul of Azeroth for something.
You know what was also pointed out to me today, which I thought was really fascinating, and this could just be a case of reused assets, but if you look at the sword that Sargeras used that's currently still sticking out of Azeroth, like, look at the art for it, that sword is in the vault inside of Korthia. There's a representation of it, the exact sword, inside of the vault. I don't think that's a mistake. I don't think it's a reused asset because it's the only other place that I've seen that art. Nowhere else. I haven't seen it repeated anywhere else. But it's in that room where you go and before the Keeper of Fates gets taken. It's in that room. Like, there's a lot more going on here than I think we realize. Like with the Grimoire, it doesn't feel like just happenstance. It feels like these are deliberate choices that are being made for environmental storytelling. Like you pointed out with the names of things that was presented to you, with the idea that, like, the sword exists in multiple places. Why? Why is it the only one other one? I would have expected to see it elsewhere if it was just a reused asset. Like, I don't know. I think we're about to find out a whole lot more, because one of the things at the end of the current campaign questing is that the Primus basically says, yes, there's way more to this story. We just don't have time. We need to go and do this, and then we'll talk later. He's basically pulling the ultimate, stereotypical book dad. I don't want to talk about this now. We have other things to worry about. Then we can talk about our emotions later. And we are going to find out more. That's not a question. It's just a question of when, and, like, how does the Sepulchre mix into this? What is the importance of it? What is he going after? What is Oval going after? And how does that tie in with everything else? And how does that specifically tie in with Azeroth? Because, again, it is repeated. The Primus says he goes for your world, or he comes for your world's soul, and we must stop him. Why is that so important? Why is that so fixated? And to bring it back to a question that I've been asking from Legion, is this something Sargeras knew about? Is this something that he found out about, or was twisted in a way, thanks to the Nathrezim, that led him to be way more interested in Azeroth than would have normally been something he would have been interested in? And is there a reason he didn't want to cleave it? And was it just because he wanted Azeroth to be a champion against the Void, that he wanted it to be part of his family? Or did he have an idea of what was going on? What do you think, Matt? Anything in there?
I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting questions there, but we don't have anything to go on in terms of it. I do think it's interesting that the Winter Queen calls Alun her sister.
Mm-hmm.
And there's clearly a relationship there. The Winter Queen also calls the other Eternal Ones from the Shadowlands sister and brother.
So does the Primus. Primus does that as well. Yeah.
And they call Zoval that.
Yeah, brother. Yep.
If Ilun is a being that the Titans worked with, and we know she is because...
Ilunaria?
Not just that. The Tear of Ilun is one of the things used to affect the Pillars of Creation. It's mm-hmm. It is a Pillar of Creation. The others were all things created by the Titans. If the Titans are beings from, like, the realm of order, and we now know the Eternal Ones kind of perform a similar role in the Shadowlands, and Ilun might be like that, say, in the Emerald Dream. And we know that both the Shadowlands and the Emerald Dream seem to be places that exist within Azeroth, or within the reality of Azeroth. They're not in the realm of death or the realm of life. You know what I mean? They're of those places, but they're not in them. They are in, like, they're in a different pocket of reality that's within the one that Azeroth itself exists in.
Hmm.
Does that mean there's an arcane realm that's where the Titans originally come from?
And where they're... The Grimoire, you know, seems to indicate something like that, too.
Yeah. And does that mean that there's a Fell One and a Light One and a Void One? There's other places like the Shadowlands. Because we know that the Void and the Light both can enter the Shadowlands. Because both have done it. The Naru have invaded Revendreth. The Void attacked Bastion. You know, it's not just the Nathrezim going around the universe playing games with them. Those games can be played right back at them. And when the Naru came to Revendreth, they effed the place up.
Mm-hmm. They laid waste to a place that is still a wasteland. It is Mad Max levels of wasteland.
So the Realm of Death is not immune to being interfered with by cosmic forces, and neither are any of these other realms. Like, there could be all sorts of stuff happening in any of them. And I keep finding myself thinking, like, you know, if there's... I hate going back to Dungeons and Dragons, but I do think it's kind of interesting to think about the way that they've done higher and lower planes of existence.
Yeah.
And how in this cosmology, like, the Grimoire of the Shadowlands basically flips around the worlds on the orrery, for lack of a better word. It puts them in different places. I wonder if there's... The Titans are kind of like the old gods and the Naru. They're a way for beings who should be dwelling outside of our reality to enter it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because we know that the Titans are like blobs of pure arcane power that get thrown into our cosmos, and then worlds get built around them to, like, hold them like pearls. Why is that? Does our universe attempt to encapsulate them because they're just this raw arcane power? There's too much. And we know what happens when there's all that arcane power, but no soul using it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got Draenor to look at. A world without a world soul, all this spirit energy generated by living things just goes into that world, and it goes off the rails.
The other thing that I keep thinking about, too, and this comes back with the Grimoire, and we're probably going to talk about the Grimoire at some point in the near future a little more in depth, but looking at the chart and looking at the original cosmology chart, and like you're saying, like they have this really interesting interplay of how they do the higher and lower planes. But I started to think about, like, maybe, and of course everybody always thinks their theories are right and clever, but a long, long, long time ago when Chronicle 1 first came out, I asked the question of, is Azeroth important because it represents a nexus point where it can touch all of the realms? And is that what Zoval wants? Is that what he needs access to? Is it that he needs Azeroth as a way to get to the arcane plane, to the plane of life, to the plane of death, beyond the Shadowlands, because there is the void plane. Does he need that to invade all of those places? We know that those other places can invade the Shadowlands, so there's definitely a way to get between them, but does he need a central point to stage warfare? And is that how he unmakes the universe? By disrupting how everything touches and interplays with each other to reform it into his own vision of what the universe should be. Again, lots of questions, but it's starting to maybe crystallize the point that Azeroth is important, maybe not necessarily because it is a world soul, but because it operates as the place where enough concentrated power exists and all of those other places touch in such a unique way compared to every other world soul that has existed. Including with Ilun's touch and everything else, that's why he needs it, so that he can start waging his war in earnest.
Let me read something to you. This is from Grimoire of the Shadowlands. One unique trait of the Night Elves is worth particular note. While most of their people's souls are born across the veil as expected, certain Night Elves may also linger in the mortal realm in a soul shape they refer to as a wisp. Mm-hmm. It is this author's opinion that this phenomenon is caused by the soul's intrinsic bonds with the magical nature of its home forest, thus creating a tether that allows the wisp to remain among the living. Though, it should be acknowledged, I cannot entirely rule out the interference of a loon, their revered deity, in this matter. As we well know, beings of her origin cannot, under any circumstance, be trusted.
Yeah.
What do they mean by that? What do they mean by her origin? Do they mean they don't trust them? Like, is this a case of, well, these beings aren't mercantile like us, so they can't be trusted because they don't have a predictable motive? Or is it something else?
Which then begs the question of how does that play into the aspects of death and the pantheon of death, who are ostensibly Alun's brothers and sisters.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And interestingly, like it puts up more questions than it answers. You know, does that, like, what are you talking about? I really want to know what they mean by all of that. But it is interesting to think about in terms of what we just talked about.
All that to say, friends, we are probably going to be finding out in the very near future as the campaign in this game marches on, because there is still much more content ahead of us. So with that, Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Again, if you have questions for this or any of our other podcasts, be sure to send them into podcast@blizzardwatch.com or one of our various Discord channels. And if you can't support us on Patreon, we do appreciate it. It does make this and other shows possible and allows us to continue and grow and diversify what we cover as a website. And as a reminder, all of us at Blizzard Watch do stand with the employees of Activision Blizzard in demanding change for a better work environment and a better tomorrow.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.